bill is being introduced is last year we became incorporated. Obviously, we've been a township for 150 years, roughly. We became a city last year. The way the law, and I'm certainly not an expert on the timing of this, but the law was written that payment in lieu of taxes for certain, I don't know if it's just DNR property or government land, when it becomes government land, there's a fee or a tax that's paid in lieu of taxes, and the law is written that it's paid to cities and townships. One could probably assume that when this was written, most cities didn't have gross acres to give to the DNR or to the state. So it's silent on the issue of cities. We became a city, in essence, then we lose that income that we get from the state. This was all kind of discovered recently, and I think this amendment was offered by a combination of the DNR, the Anoka County, and, of course, Columbus. It affects any community that becomes, it's written so that any community that becomes incorporated, or in other words, becomes a city after January, I think, of 2006, whatever it says here exactly. Again, I didn't write it, but it's effective last year. And, of course, you're seeing more and more communities or townships in the metropolitan area that are not the typical downtown where you simply have a city surrounded by a township. You can go all the way from Scandia, Forest Lake, Ham Lake, East Bethel, Andover, and, of course, ourselves, where there's a lot of land that certainly can be converted to DNR property. It amounts to some $30,000 payment in lieu of taxes that we would lose if this amendment is not adopted. And we have representative here from Anoka County, Rhonda Sivaraja, a commissioner, and maybe she can give you the Anoka County's perspective.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rhonda Sivaraja, Anoka County Commissioner, and I represent Columbus, the city of Columbus. And Anoka County is very supportive of this legislation. It makes no sense to us as a county that just because we have a township that moved from becoming a township into being incorporated into a city, that suddenly Anoka County gets their portion of the payment in lieu of taxes. So we are very supportive of this legislation and allowing the city to continue to receive the payment in lieu of taxes rather than it coming to the county. Anoka County, or the city of Columbus, is unique in that Anoka County, back in the early 1960s, came before the legislature and asked that our townships really be given urban powers. And so they have operated all of the zoning authority within the townships, the comprehensive planning, and really have been able to plan adequately for their future, for the time that they decided to incorporate. And so they've already been operating as a city for a number of years. To us, it's a matter of them changing their name from the Township of Columbus to the City of Columbus. And again, as I said, we are very supportive of this legislation.
Yes. When you say that they've already been operating as a city, do you mean that they've been doing things that cities do in terms of planning and development?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. Certainly there are certain things that a city does differently than what a township does, but in many other counties, certainly in the rural or greater Minnesota areas of the state, the county board has zoning authority for many of the townships. However, in Anoka County, that's not been the case since the early 1960s. All of our townships have had their own zoning authority. And so as a county, we were not telling them how to do land use planning and so forth. That was all up to the individual community. is we thought they knew their community best. Let them control their own destiny.
Senator Vandeveer, welcome.
Thank you.
We took the bill a little out of order with regards to your witnesses. Usually you would go first. But if you'd Ms. Sivaraja, if you're done, we can have Senator Vandeveer make any comments that he would like.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I think the bill's very straightforward. It's simply dealing with PILT. With a city that's become, or a township that's become a city. It's pretty narrowly drafted and just says that the town or the city can continue to receive the bill. That's the bill.
So why doesn't this apply to any city?
It would.
Well, Mr. Chair, I believe it would.
But it's like you said, it's narrowly crafted. Well, it really only applies to the city of Columbus.
Well, Mr. Chair, actually, any town that received a payment in calendar year 2006 or thereafter, so a township that would be incorporated in Minnesota after this date would still be able to keep its PILT payments. So I believe it's just not intended to go backwards, I think, is when I say it's narrowly drafted, so that there wouldn't change the status of existing cities at this point.
Mr. Chairman, I mentioned before, this is especially in the metro area on the fringe, it's fairly common, I think, for whatever the reasons, for townships to become incorporated. In our own little area, we have Scandia, which was just incorporated. That's in Washington County. Wyoming Township is in the process of becoming merged with the city of Wyoming. I think that you'll probably see more. The fact that townships are on the edge of the metro area, I think, has a lot to do with the move to become incorporated.
Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One other comment. This is, I think the PILT payments themselves are kind of unique in this in some respects because of the Carlos Avery. I'm not sure if that was discussed, but the DNR is here too, and I'm not, would you like to comment, sir? That's
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Paul Pojar. I work for the Department of Natural Resources, and for the last 4 or 5 years, I've been specifically working on payment in lieu of taxes. There's actually two payments in lieu of taxes, one under Chapter 477A and the other one under 97A.01.061. And the difference between the two is under 477A, all lands that are owned by the state and managed by the Department of Natural Resources are included. This bill deals with those that are under 97A, and those are the ones that are hunting-related lands. And so rather than selecting the one that deals with all lands in general, we dealt with the hunting land specifically because in Columbus Township, Carlos Avery is the main WMA wildlife management area that is impacted by this bill. And so in other counties or other townships that may incorporate into cities, if they have hunting lands involved, and this would be an incorporation into the future, as was explained a little earlier, they may fall under this law. Scandia Township was mentioned here is also incorporating. They do not have WMAs. They have trails. They have water access sites. They have the state park, William O'Brien. Because those are not hunting lands, they would not fit under this bill. So It was written narrowly to cover hunting lands located within a township that had incorporated into a city. After, I think it's 2006, it might have been January 1st, 2006. It's the calendar year of 2006.
Why don't cities already, why haven't we already contemplated cities getting PILT payments?
Mr. Chair, we're not quite sure. We've never, haven't received an explanation as to why it was restricted to, or why it, a township becoming a city didn't continue to collect the PILT. And I'm not sure if in the other committees it hasn't come, no one's come forth with a reason unless somebody here has one.
Mr. Chairman, I would suspect it was probably because as these hunting lands were identified or designated by the department, they were being designated in the more rural areas, less likely to have cities involved. And also, cities often have ordinances with associated with shooting firearms within city limits, and so we would have probably not been purchasing lands for hunting within those areas. That's the only explanation I can give you, but it's not only applies to the hunting lands, but it also is in that 477A, which is a broader mix of DNR lands. Townships are the only thing that are mentioned in there as well.
Mr. Chairman?
I'm sorry, what did you say, Mr.
I was going to say, Mr. Chairman, the other thing I'd add to Mr. Pojar just said is under the 477A land, school districts also don't receive money from the PILT payments. So, in fact, these are a little bit different in how it's done. The PILT payments under 477A are treated differently than the ones under 97A061.
And the main difference being?
The main difference being, as I understand it, is the school districts receive. Basically, under 97A061 are the hunting lands. They're supposed to allocate the payments on the same basis as if the payments were taxes on the land received in that year for the school districts, town, and county, but not for the city. Under 477A, it only goes to the county and town. And if there's not an organized town, then the county retains all of the money. And there's no allocation to school districts and no allocation to cities.
And Mr. Mettler, if Columbus knew that it was going to lose its PILT payments, why did it incorporate?
Well, I'm not even sure we were aware of it. There's a lot of reasons why we went through the incorporation, and that wasn't one of the main factors that was addressed last year when this all happened. It was a court. We went through the process, and I can't ever remember that. We went through an analysis of what the pluses and minuses and costs for and against. I can't recall that ever being brought up. I don't think we realized it. I don't know if the county realized it, so I can't say any more than that.
Now that you're a city, and you're still receiving PILT payments because of Carlos Avery, and then it's also Lamprey Pass and Huel, right?
Actually, we're not receiving the PILT payments.
You did before you incorporated, correct?
Before, as a township, sure.
And that was because of Carlos Avery, Lamprey Pass, and Huel, right? Is that correct?
I'm not sure what the rules which apply. There's a lot of DNR or a lot of state-owned land in Columbus.
Mr. Pojar?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that is correct. There are a few small parcels that are scattered throughout. I would assume those may be water access sites, something like that. But the major, larger blocks of land managed by the DNR are those hunting wildlife management areas, the hunting lands of Carlos Avery, Huel, and Lamprey Pass.
The bill says that Columbus will not receive the PILT payments if you pass an ordinance that prohibits hunting within the boundaries of the city, but I presume it relates to Carlos Avery and the two others, how will you also address the issue of hunting in Carlos Avery, Lamprey Pass, and Huel with the encroachment of the development, whether it be commercial or residential?
Mr. Chair, I do believe that Senator Frederickson would have an amendment proposed. I think our intent here originally in the intent of the department was that hunting not be restricted in the wildlife management area and that and not the boundaries of the entire city. So that
I presume that's what you mean. So if you have an amendment to clarify that, that's good.
I can comment on that. A good share of Columbus is rural, and where most of the land abutting any of the DNR property is rural. There's probably some exceptions. This was something the DNR wanted in this bill. We saw no problem with it from Columbus's standpoint. We have never contemplated putting anything like that in any restrictions. It's never been discussed. So I don't see that as a problem.
I got on that rural, I got a zoning map of the city of Columbus, and there I see a lot of amongst the zoning districts. I think members have it in their packets as well. RR residential, is that rural residential classification?
Yes.
And I see a lot of for lack of a better word, I see a lot of smaller lots along the borders of Carlos Avery. Is that a growing trend in the city of Columbus?
The lots size, minimum lot size in Columbus has been 5 acres since, I believe, 79.
Those aren't any smaller.
So we're not, we're not changing that. That's not being contemplated politically. It's not a move that I can see happening. We have an area down on the freeway, 35W, 35E runs there. That's commercial. That's sewered and watered. That will allow smaller lots, but they will be. That's commercial, not residential. The whole rest of the city is 5 acre minimums. Any smaller lots were platted prior to 79.
And that's a part, the 35W and 35E. That's the
It's
part.
It's a south east corner.
And that's where that proposed harness track is going.
Correct.
Okay. How are you dealing with the encroachment on Lamprey Pass and the Huel WMA? Do you have any? Are you establishing any buffers with that zoning, or is it just going to eliminate the first 500 feet from hunting on those WMAs?
Most of it is natural. There's an awful lot of wetland in Columbus. It has not been an issue. We haven't done any special planning. I know that it's a topic of discussion with the DNR as to the boundary between hunting land and property. That's not unique to us. That's just general discussion I've heard. We have not had it come up as an issue anyplace. And like I say, I'll emphasize, there's a lot of natural boundaries, especially around this freeway district, this 3 square miles. It's 1 mile wide, 3 miles high. It's wetlands east, west, and north, essentially.
At the moment, but they're zoned for something different for the future.
But with the restrictions with wetlands, I can't see that changing. We have to basically live with the land as it stands. There's very little mitigation that happens. I mean, that's one of the things that one of the processes. But like I say, there's a tremendous amount of wetlands in the area. So
how did this all get zoned differently then? Apparently there's a plan for industrial and commercial showrooms.
The zoning in that freeway district actually was admitted to the MUSA line in 1999, and we've worked on that since 99 and the zoning in that area, except for the addition of the harness racing or the horse racing track where that area is. That's been developed over the last 5-6 years. That probably won't change. It's strictly the commercial area. Now, we've got a comp plan coming up, as does everybody else, and we'll look at everything. The preliminary input I've had is that we're not going to make too many changes. There's no reason to make any changes.
I don't understand what you said. You've got a commercial retail plan on this zoning map right up against the Lamprey Pass Wildlife Management Area. This is the map that I'm looking at. It's from the city of Columbus.
Yes.
So presumably you're going to have commercial retail there,
that's
particularly on the northwest side of 35 and 23. And it looks like right along Howard Lake. So how can that not encroach on a WMA?
Is that a WMA? First of all, is that a WMA?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. There'll be a border, obviously. And like I said, to the north, there's a pretty natural area of wetlands and lowlands that won't be developed.
Mr. Chairman, if you know it all along...
Ms. Sivaraja.
Thank you. All along Rice Creek, going all the way up to Howard Lake, that piece there is Anoka County Parkland. It's part of the Rice Creek Chain of Lakes Regional Park.
Mm-hmm.
And so that piece as well is all protected. So obviously there won't be development in that area either.
There's no hunting on that either.
There is, Mr. Chairman, hunting with a permit.
Okay.
It is allowed on that property. That was one of the agreements that we made with the City of Columbus when Anoka County acquired property from the St. Paul Water Utility.
Is the east side of the Huel WMA, is that a different city or township?
Mr.
And if so, do you know what that's zoned?
Excuse me, to the east is Washington County, and that's Forest Lake.
Okay.
And I think that's rural residential. Now, it's in an area that I don't know if that'll be changed or not, but that's in Forest Lake.
Okay.
There's a lot of wetlands in that area, too, of course.
The recurring question I have is that you've got the prohibition on hunting as long as you receive the PILT payments, but how do you prevent the encroachment on hunting with the 500-foot rule if you're developing all along these WMAs?
500-foot rule wouldn't apply. 500-foot rule wouldn't apply. It's public land. The 500-foot rule only applies to private land. Or right of ways.
You can shoot all along.
Mm-hmm. As long as it's public land.
It has not been an issue. I don't. We have not got a plan for. We've got DNR property, wildlife management property all over the city, and I don't think we've done anything special as far as encroachment one way or the other. It just has not come up.
Is DNR planning to expand any of these WMAs?
There's been, over the years, there's been acquisitions. There will probably be continue to be. And actually, we have started some talks with a man out of Carlos Avery to come up with some kind of a plan for what Carlos Avery or what the DNR in general is going to do in the future as how we can cooperate and work together with that. We've had one meeting. We will schedule another one as soon as we get the minutes and have a chance to discuss that. So the plan is to try and cooperate with the DNR as to future plans. In the past, it's been kind of piecemeal. For one reason or another, land becomes available. They buy it. They may not buy it. And we're trying to come up with some kind of a plan that will fit everybody, the DNR, as well as the city. And that is the goal of probably the immediate future here.
But if someone wants to sell their land to the DNR, the city is not going to stand in the way, are they?
Depends. We've in general, that's true. But they come to us according to the law, the way it reads. They must come for local approval.
What does it depend on?
The lay of the land, the accessibility, the developability.
I'm sorry, I saw some hands up earlier.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it was on the point.
Senator Olson, then Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, your comment about the incorporation in the metropolitan area, there are cities that chose to incorporate that didn't have business districts at all. There were agricultural and residential, and they did so to protect that. In the rural area, the townships are essentially maids in waiting, if you will, that as the incorporated cities needed to expand or there was that pressure, they would add land taken from the townships, and the townships' boundaries were not secure from that standpoint to be able to enlarge the cities. But in the metropolitan area, many of the townships incorporated to protect their boundaries and have some say about their fate. That's precisely the process that got me involved in politics, which was to incorporate to protect from the encroachment of people looking for higher density in an area with natural beauty and wanting to protect both the rural character as well as the agriculture. Mm-hmm. And there's still a fair number of cities in the metropolitan area that there's some townships in Dakota County and others, but in Carver and Scott, but in particularly in Hennepin County, that was a very quick move on many part to mm-hmm. just to slow that down. And so the idea that somebody would incorporate is not to push development. And back at that time, the subdivision, actually the subdivision of 5 acres, almost secures the fact that it's not going to develop much beyond that, because it's very hard to do anything economical in developing and dividing up 5 acre parcels. Yeah. So that kind of assures a fair amount of that character for some time, if that in fact is what your intent is out there. And it looks like you don't have a whole lot of area that would allow for that kind of a high density development to support city services.
Senator Dillon.
Am I without knowing? I mean, just in general, what the lay of the land that could be a part of it.
Senator Miller, that's exactly true. I mean, keeping the rural character, the 5-acre minimums, is absolutely going to happen. I mean, the popularity of it, we pride ourselves on that. We got involved with the annexation incorporation issue last year to keep our freeway district. We want a diversity of tax base. It's there. That's where there's a freeway there. We wouldn't be doing that if it wasn't for the freeway. We have a potential for a lot of tax base there. That actually allows us to keep the rest of the city rural, just as you said. And that politically is a very popular approach.
But, Mr. Chairman,
and furthermore, you're right. We don't have a lot of high ground. We have to treat it very carefully.
But, Mr. Chairman, I think you're you may be unique in terms of the you were receiving PILT. But the lay of the land, if you will, and the nature of that makes you somewhat unique. I can't see that there's an awful lot of other places around in this metropolitan area that would incorporate, that would fit the same situation as you're proposing here in your bill.
Well, it's a very unique situation.
Pardon me?
It's a very unique situation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's just probably will become less and less unique.
Yes.
Well, I mean,
how could...
Well, I mean, you've got... WMAs in Dakota County, other counties, that will eventually be townships that will eventually be seeing the same situation. But at the moment, this is kind of a one-of-a-kind. And mm-hmm. Carlos Avery is one-of-a-kind as well. I don't think there is a larger WMA in the metro area. And so we've got the township encroachment issue, and then you've got the WMA encroachment issue. And I think it's very important that we consider both. Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, somebody at the table, how much money are we talking about in PILT payments?
We currently receive, Senator Dill, I'm sorry, I called you a senator. I can't see that far away, Ms. Senator Olson. We currently receive about $34,000. That's for all the property that in our property.
And then, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask the county commissioner, you said something, I got the impression from what you said that you were receiving. Are you receiving both the county share and the township share right now, or the city share, because they're not getting it because they're a city?
Ms. Sivaraja.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, the way that the law currently exists, the county would begin now for the year 2007 receiving the city's portion or the old township's portion.
Okay.
And to us, that didn't make a whole lot of sense.
Okay, then I understood that correctly then. Then the other question I have.
So what was the answer that the county is getting?
The county's getting the city's share.
Okay.
Or will be. Now, is there any city water and sewer provided anywhere within this city?
Mr. Miller?
Yes. Senator Dill, we have an operating sewer and water in this 3 square miles, what we call the freeway district. It's recent. The sewer's been in operation 2 years. The water was just commissioned last year. That's the only area that's in the MUSA line for sewer. Water, we haven't contemplated anything else. So that's 3 square miles. Again, the interstate runs right down the middle of it. It's 1 mile wide, three miles high, and that's the only area. Sewer and water is.
Okay, well, Mr. Chairman, members, I'd just like to express my opinion on this 5-acre lot business. I don't think that does much to maintain the rural character. I would rather see clustered development with city water and sewer available rather than have 5-acre lots scattered all over the place. If you don't count the need for roads, that amounts to 128 homes per square mile scattered in a way that's very hard to provide city water and sewer, and it costs more for government to deliver government services to those scattered developments. And just you got a lot of open space I see anywhere in this township, but I think just as a general rule, it's better to have clustered development and maintain more open space rather than have a home every 5 acres. That's just my opinion.
That's something that's actually this is something the LCMR went and looked at this past fall in the, I think it was city of East Bethel. There was a proposed development, very controversial. There's old growth oaks, and there's a proposed development. I think it was 1 acre situation there. Or is it one of the two? It was 1 acre or 5 acre, and it was butting up right up to the WMA. And there was big controversy, and environmental groups, and developers, and what happened was is that the developer came up with an alternative plan that had this kind of clustered development with the wildlife corridors. It was a little probably less of a rural feel, but it was better for the wildlife for one. In the end, it kind of maintained the rural feel of the whole area, except for that one clustered development. But the city rejected that. And it was an agreement, too. I guess I have a lot of questions about, cities, going back to your comment about, if someone wants to sell their land to DNR to protect their protect the WMA or expand the WMA, or if someone wants to develop an environmentally friendly area way, although that was not a Columbus issue, I'm just concerned that we're not able to do that at the local level, and that the priority concern seems to be development. I'm sure the harness track is driving that. So that's just my feeling on it. Senator Bickerman?
Mr. Chair, is this a piece of property that I brought to your attention one day that they didn't want to sell it to the WMA, or am I, is that another piece? Remember, I brought it to your attention.
I don't recall what you brought to my attention.
It might have been a different piece.
Okay.
I just didn't want it to be developed. I thought it should be part of these things.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Mettler.
Can I comment on Mr. Dill's comments? We've just had a lot of discussion over cluster development and how it would fit. It's not politically very popular in Columbus. It's probably because it's just not conducive. We have the five-acre minimums may be misleading. We've got, depending upon how you want to count it, 40%, 50%, 60% wetland area. It's not conducive to any kind of municipal sewer, perhaps community sewers where you have several houses on one drain field and septic system. That's been discussed too. We've spent a lot of time. It just doesn't seem to be very conducive. Maybe sometime it will be. For now, certainly for the foreseeable future, that's not going to happen. Most of the land that was easy to put houses on has already happened. There's a few exceptions to that. Everything else we have to work around wetlands and the buildability, the suitability of how to make it work. And we can almost write the book on high water tables in making sure that, I mean, that's, we just live with that. Every property that comes in, every development, that is the key. And we know it pretty well. We've got pretty strict rules, literally to the point where some people think we are trying to stop development, or not development of commercial, but residential houses. The commercial area is sewered, so that's a different story. And again, we only got that 3 square miles down here.
Senator Bickerman, the answer to your question is yes. This is the issue.
Yeah.
The on the yellow portion on the map is a section that individuals wanted to sell to the DNR, but the statute says that a county must approve of a sale to the state if it's for a WMA. Mm-hmm. And so so it went to Anoka County, and I don't think Anoka County, from what I understand, I think Anoka County was Ms. Sivaraja, you can probably characterize the county's feelings better than me, but from what the debate I saw, there was reluctance from the part of the county to about this whole statute, and you know, why do we have to get involved with local control of the city of Columbus? Do you want to comment?
Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to comment on that. Again, going back to Anoka County being pretty unique as far as our townships having the zoning and planning authority, that is unique for counties that have townships. And so we had given the zoning authority through the statute and legislation that was passed in the early 1960s to our townships. So this is the only instance at all that something comes to the county board for a land use or zoning authority. And we, you know, we certainly feel as though the local unit of government is really the ones that should be deciding that. And so we were supportive of their position
in regard to
this particular.
I think if you have someone who wants to sell a piece of land to someone, they should be the one who makes the decision who to sell it to. But that's just me. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Meyer, would the passage of this, or the establishment of this policy in statute, help or hinder the DNR in terms of protecting and being able to expand where they wished in terms of their wildlife management areas or the areas that are in this area?
Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner of DNR. As you know, we did work with the City of Columbus on this language. The DNR, being such a large landowner, we have a good neighbor policy, as any large landowner does, making sure you work with your neighbors and where you own that land to make sure that your expectations are understood and you know what your neighbor's expectations are and you're working together to manage your lands in cooperation. That is our success. We cannot go into an area, into a county, into a township, and buy land without support. The transaction you're talking about, Columbus Township, did not want that whole transaction to take place. We're working with them to try to figure out perhaps maybe parts of that land can be purchased.
Which transaction and which land are you referring to?
Take a look at the map.
Yeah, I'm looking at the map, but I wasn't following what you were talking about.
There's a yellow square.
Yes?
And we're talking about, I believe it's 120 acres or so. And the individual or individuals who wanted to sell this portion to the DNR so that it could be attached to the WMA, Carlos Avery WMA. So that's what we're talking about.
And Mr. Chairman, and Columbus doesn't want to do that?
No, it was brought before us, and we, as has several parcels over the years, as far as I know, it's the first time we've ever turned one down.
Why did you turn it down?
Mr. Mettler.
Land that was a developable and accessible, among other reasons. It's an hour discussion when you start talking about all the pros and cons and the different people have a chance to talk. So when it came down to a vote, it was actually 3-2 in favor of not approving the sale.
So, Mr. Chairman, even though that's in a floodplain?
Access to this road.
Looks like that's all floodplain under there.
Well, I don't know if that map shows it clearly. You can see it. Virtually every part of, not every part, but virtually every part of Columbus has a mixture of wetlands and high ground. So that's that. From that standpoint, it's not unique. The accessibility to the high ground from one spot to the next, that is one of the factors. Now, subsequently, the next meeting, the DNR came with another chunk of land, 160 acres, that probably had about identically the same mix. Identical is the wrong word. A very similar mix of high ground and wetland, and we approved that. It depends upon the accessibility, how it, where it is with respect to the development that's already there.
And Mr. Chairman, that spot looks like it's out in the... Well, is it some lakeshore? Is that the issue?
No, there's no lakeshore.
It's like it's just in the middle of a floodplain or swamp itself,
right.
Or wetland.
Right.
But that's not the case. That little yellow patch is.
Well, that's 160 acres, Senator, and there's depending upon how you measure wetland, I believe. The majority of it is wetland, two-thirds, something like that, but that still leaves quite a bit of high ground. And, again, where do you draw this line between what's going to Carlos Avery, part of the wildlife management area, what's going to not be, and what's going to be retained by the city?
Well, Mr. Chairman and sir, now I'm finally connected with it because I didn't understand what that conversation was. But if you're interested in preserving the rural character, as you said, and you're wanting pilt, I mean, if that went into a wildlife management area, you would receive pilt payments for that as well. That seems to be counter to what. The direction of your request and that decision seems to be counter.
Mr. Mettler.
Chairman.
The
idea of what's developed and what is development and what isn't. To me, one house back there that's worth $1 million pays a lot more than what we're getting now, which is about the property tax on it right now is about $3,000, I believe, somewhere in that neighborhood. Don't quote me on that, but it's in that neighborhood. It's not very much. One house back in that area or two houses that are fairly secluded would be tax-based for us and certainly would not affect the wildlife in that area.
So, Mr. Chairman, you're saying that that particular parcel would attract, would have the potential of having $1 million house or certain, one or two certain, large homes?
And is it upscale, don't quote me on $1 million. 10 years ago, I would have said no. As land has become more valuable this close to the cities, we've found that developers or individual homeowners, instead of coming in and, I mean, you have to visualize, this is not a field where you can just come up and divide it into 5-acre chunks and put a house there. This is where you have to utilize the land, the high ground. By law, it has to have be suitable to put a sewer in it. And you can put certain houses, and we've found lately that the people who want that kind of land are willing to pay a lot more and put up much nicer houses. It's a seclusion factor. And my other point, of course, is the impact on the wildlife in that area will be very slim. We're not talking about 20, 30, 40 houses back there. It's not conducive for that.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I do have an amendment if you're ready for that.
Okay. We'll take care of that. I think Senator Bickerman had a follow-up, and then sure. We'll get your amendment.
Mr. Chair, we've been struggling here for the last month on no net loss and all how precious wetland is. I can't see why this wouldn't be better. I don't care if you build $1 million house. You can't put a price on that piece of property if you put it into wetland management, unless I'm missing something in this operation. That's my concern. Now listen to see what Senator Fredrickson says.
Senator Fredrickson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move to amend this paragraph C. And a couple of the changes I'm going to make are clearly technical, and then the remainder is just to more clearly define the policy we're trying to establish. I would move on page 1, line 19, delete incorporated and insert incorporates. On line 21, delete governing body of the and after city, insert council. And on line 22, after prohibits, insert the discharge of firearms or
bone arrow.
And also on line 22, delete city and insert state land for which the payment is received. So, Mr. Chairman, I'll read that last phrase as it would read as I amended it. Provided that the payments will terminate if the City Council passes an ordinance that prohibits the discharge of firearms or hunting within the boundaries of the state land for which the payment is received.
That makes sense.
Okay. This kind of just clarifies that we mean that this portion about hunting can continue within the boundaries of Columbus. We mean within the WMA, not, you know, at the harness racing track. Although, now, what are you going to do with the starter gun? What are you going to do with the starter gun? That will be prohibited.
Sure, I think that's a different problem for another time.
Well, if they prohibited it, they'd lose their bill. Right.
Well, there you go. They
prohibited the starter gun.
Yeah. Okay.
Why would they do that?
They don't. They got a cart. They follow around. There's a car with a gate. No gun.
Will this then, Ms. Sivaraja, will this then, this change affect the hunting by permit on that Rice Creek corridor that you were alluding to earlier?
Mr. Chairman, it would not change that at all. One of the agreements when we acquired additional property, one of the agreements that Anoka County had with the then Township of Columbus was that we would allow hunting permits to be issued as our county process allows in other certain park areas as well. So that would continue as it currently does. This would have no effect on that.
Is this a conflict, Mr. Knopf?
Mr. Chairman, no. I think that as stated by the witness that this wouldn't affect that situation.
Okay. Okay. Everyone understand the amendment? Seeing no further discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. So we have Senate File 1937. As amended.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
We still lose a piece of property that should be part of that WMA. Or am I missing something?
That is true. That is true.
Mr. Chairman, this bill does not affect that either one way or the other, with or without this bill.
Nothing to do with it.
Yes, this parcel under this bill would not, the sale, the prohibited sale would not be affected by this bill. It would still be prohibited by the City of Columbus under this bill.
But we're giving them an incentive to approve it.
Say that again, Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, I just pointed out that it would give them an incentive to approve it, because if they do approve the sale, the township would actually would receive PILT payments for that.
Okay. Okay. Probably not as near as much as the $1 million house they're planning to put on the property.
That's right.
Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that Senate File 1937, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Taxes.
Further discussion on the motion? Senator Vickerman, I don't think this bill deals with this issue, but I think it has to be dealt with somehow. I mean, in northern counties. You've got the opposite situation. You've got the DNR, the lots of public land, and the county has to, really needs to approve the sale, because that's taxes off the rolls. And this is kind of the reverse situation, where you've got tons of development, and you want to protect every bit of public land that you can. And we have a statute that, that conflicts with that. But this bill is not the deal with that. Further discussion on the motion? Senator Sharon, you had a
no. Okay. We were a little confused about the referral to taxes, but you're talking about the because it had already been heard in tax committee. Is that correct?
Yeah. What is basically with a couple of the bills? There was a Tomasoni bill. There's this bill. There's a Saxhog bill that should have come to our committee first and then to taxes. Instead, they went straight to taxes. So we requested the bill from taxes to review it, and then we'll send it back to taxes, because that was the normal course of action of referral. And taxes will probably want to see it again, because we've amended it. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Members, that smell is not meant to torture you. dig in. There's pizza for the members and staff.
Mr. Chairman, what is the boundary of Carlos Avery? It's not the floodplain line, is it?
No.
It doesn't show clearly on here.
It kind of, this is just the City of Columbus, but it kind of, it juts out ways.
But it says up here and down here. Is it all this land in between?
Well, that's a good
place. I don't see any marker that shows a boundary.
It's a little hard to see. It's the dotted stuff that is gray. There's dotted stuff that's purely blue, and there's dotted stuff that's kind of grayish.
Okay.
That's the boundary. A little hard to see.
It's pretty big territory. It covers a good chunk of the city.
Absolutely. And you want to look at the Lamprey Pass WMA between the two lakes?
Yeah, I see that one.
That was the the first place I ever hunted. And now they're putting a racetrack in there. And Carlos Avery was. And Carlos Avery was the second place I ever hunted. I've spent a lot of time on Carlos Avery.
Now they're going to have $1 million homes there. So you've got a lot.
Yeah, if you can imagine the. Oh yeah, there you go. We should all chip in.
Well, I don't know. That part. Yeah,
could you imagine the? I mean, encroach. You know. 500-foot buffer or not, can you imagine what that million-dollar home owner is going to say to the city when there are gunshots going off near his house? I mean, there's going to be a lot of public pressure to cut off hunting in that area, and I'm very fearful of that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think this would protect that, and they might just attract somebody who wants that hunting to be handy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
who would probably be the person shooting.
That's where a lot of our lands are disappearing to people who do want
I
to
bought
hunt.
That piece of property, I'd be out there shooting.
Hopefully that's the right buyer. Yeah. Hopefully that's the right buyer.
I think it was. Yeah.
I thought DNR was a sure bet, but that's all right. Okay, so help yourself to pizza, and Senators... Senator, all right, you've got Senator Sieben chomping at the bit.
Yeah, get this done, hurry up.
Mr. Chair and members, this Senate File 728 is a technical bill that came to me from the DNR, and I'd first like to move the A1 amendment, please, to get the bill in the shape that I would prefer.
Okay. Author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Aye. Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The A1 amendment simply put the bill in the shape that it is in the House. There were some minor changes. But the general overall of Senate File 728 is that, as members know, the DNR holds contested case hearings on permits or orders. And if someone doesn't agree with the DNR decision, they have the right to seek an administrative review under Chapter 14, the Administrative Procedures Act. And Chapter 14 does not require publication of the notice in a newspaper, but Statute 103G.311 does require the full notice of the public hearing at the expense of the applicant. So this legislation would simply allow for a summary of that hearing, still at the expense of the applicant. So there's no fiscal impact for the DNR. And I'd also just like to note that the Administrative Law Judge Office is okay with this bill. So here to speak in favor of the bill is Kent Lacasmo, the Director of the Division of Waters for DNR.
Welcome to committee. Mr. Chairman, thank you. Kent Lacasmo, Director of the Division of Waters for DNR. I think Senator Sieben gave a pretty good summary of what this bill does. This bill only deals with the publication aspect of the notice for the hearing. It does not restrict anybody's rights to a hearing. It doesn't exempt us from the Chapter 14 hearing process and the notice requirements under Chapter 14. I think that were some of the confusion in the way the bill was previously drafted. So this, as the bill was amended, does exactly the same thing. And I can just hold up a notice of a hearing that we held last year, and we were required to do this entire notice in the legal paper. And what we're asking to do under this process is essentially the yellow highlighted areas would be a summary. So anybody that actually reads these legal notices could get an idea of what the project is that we're going to hearing on. And if somebody wanted a full notice, they could ask for it, and we'd provide it either via mail or posted or whatever. So the full notice is going to be provided to the administrative law judge and to all the parties, as is required in Chapter 14. what this does really is save the applicant or the violator money. Some of these notices recently have cost $800-$900, and that's a cost that's borne by the applicant. So it doesn't make any difference to DNR. Somebody else is paying that bill, but we think it's good government to keep those costs down and to actually have a notice that somebody could get a summary and understand it without reading through that lengthy notice.
Mr. Chairman, is the option of getting the full notice online anywhere? Do you have that electronically, or does that not appear anywhere else but what it would be, whatever is published?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, it isn't specified. I mean, that's one of the things that we talked about doing is just posting. We could post it online, but we have to prepare the full notice under Chapter 14 for the administrative law judge and all of the parties. So we have that available, and we could make that available to anybody that requests it, either electronically or we could post it.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chairman, I didn't mean as an alternative at this point. I understand the hearing part, but whether if they wanted the full, is it available electronically? And you're saying it is?
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. Any questions? Anyone? Senator Stump.
Mr. Lacasmo, how come you didn't do this about 10 years ago?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stump, it was only recently that the administrative law judge or our own attorney said that we had to do the complete full notice. They had some change in the attorney general's office that said we had to do this full, very lengthy notice, and then the costs, or maybe the costs of publication have just increased over time, too. So it's now somewhat more of a shocking number when you get an $800, $900 bill that we pass on to an applicant.
Anyone want to testify against this bill? Okay. Senator Sieben will move that, what is it, Senate file 728 as amended. We recommend it to pass and we refer to the Committee on State and Local Government. Any other discussion? All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
She wants bills as easy as this. Senator Scogin. She wants to have bills as easy as this.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I thought you voted against it.
Oh. You could do that, too. It's always an option.
Members, while we have a pause, I was going to – we've notified your offices about the process for this week's omnibus bill, but I thought I'd explain it out loud as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, because our LA is
not
sick. Neither of us have had time to turn on our computer.
Okay. We don't have a schedule.
Okay. All right.
We're wondering during the day.
Thursday – we will, we're going to assemble through a delete all the game and fish portion of our section and of our bill and then adopt it onto Senator Scogin's vehicle. And then we'll lay that Senate file over. So we'll have the game and fish portion done for the most part. And then on Thursday, we'll also distribute a proposed delete all for the omnibus bill. So we'll go through that on Thursday, and you'll know what's in the proposed delete all, and you'll have time to prepare amendments. And then we'll take up the actual passage of the delete all, including the game and fish portion, on Friday. So you'll have plenty of time to review, discuss, debate, and offer any amendments on Friday. And then we'll ship out the omnibus policy bill on Friday. Any questions on that? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Everybody know that we have anything going Saturday here?
Oh, even story
mentioned. I want to be around. I'm just wondering if we could fill it in for.
No. Who told him to do that?
Senator Ingebrigtsen,
can I make a motion to that effect?
Senator, you're invited to attend committee on Saturday.
Okay. I want to get a lot of work done that day. passed my first bill.
Okay, so Senator Scogin, Senate File 961.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. If you'll turn your attention to Senate File 961, a bill that deals with something that I grew up around in the Battle Lake Phelps Mill area. We had many, many family resorts, and I spent a lot of time on Pickerel Lake. And although they have diminished in number around the state of Minnesota, they still are an important part of not only the economy of rural Minnesota and the Lakes Country, but also hours and hours of fun and entertainment for families who not only from Minnesota get away for the weekend, but from Indiana and Illinois and Nebraska that still come for a week or 2 weeks at a time. And this bill, Senate File 961, deals with that. I would like to start with an A2 amendment that would put this bill that you are considering in the same order as we see it over in the House, and so I need that.
This is the A2. People should have it on top of their folders. So this is an author's amendment as well. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
You're going to find Senate File 961 consistent with existing local government law. It allows these small resorts to maintain, repair, and rebuild their operations. It allows them to expects them to follow all federal, state, and local code requirements, and it talks a little bit about what they can do in the event that they need to repair or remodel. And with me this evening is Joel Carlson. Joel tonight is representing Congress of Minnesota Resorters, along with Tom O'Sell, who is from Northern Lights Resort. And I'll turn it over to Mr. Carlson.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of the Congress of Minnesota Resorts, which is an organization of small, family-owned resort operations in Minnesota. I've had the pleasure of representing them since 1996. The bill that you have before you assists resorts by allowing them the flexibility to rebuild their facilities if they're lost through natural disaster or if they are aging and in need of repair. And those resorts are the access points for most or many of your constituents to our great Minnesota lakes. And we once numbered about over 3,000 small resorts in Minnesota. We're down to about 900. And about 4 or 5 years ago, resorters started talking to me about issues that they had with local zoning where they were unable to get permits to replace windows in their facilities or to put on new roofs because they were a non-conforming use within the shore impact zone. The bill that you have before you is a product of several years of fine-tuning with local governments and others to get down to a basic statewide standard as it relates to these minimal issues of just having the right to rebuild your operation. To go through the bill just briefly, as Senator Scogin mentioned, it's very simple, main section of the bill provides for the first time in Minnesota law a definition of what a resort is. And we think that that's something that is lacking in current law, but we wanted that to be clear that the protections that would be in that would be afforded to resorts are clear. So we included a definition of a resort. Subdivision 2 also deals with the maintenance and replacements of resorts, and I draw your attention on the amendment to line 1.29 and 1.30. And that requires a resort, if they are lost to a disaster, to make an application to rebuild that facility within 180 days. That is consistent with Minnesota law right now as it relates to non-conforming uses. And so that language, we already have that ability, although it's not always, its knowledge is not always widespread among resorters and zoning authorities. And so this makes it clear that this is consistent with non-conforming use rebuilding authority that's currently in law. The The third provision in Subdivision 4 is something that we need desperately. And resorts that were built at in the 40s and 50s maybe had a bedroom for two people that was 100 square feet. The Department of Health has a requirement right now that an individual sleeping space must be at least 60 square feet per individual. So if you got a two-person bedroom, you need 120 square feet. This bill allows us not lakeward but backward to minimally expand so that you can meet those code requirements that are currently in place that weren't when you built the original structure. That minimal expansion cannot be lakeward, and that is just critical for proper health and safety requirements that we currently find. There are also issues in certain instances relative to handicap accessibility and other requirements that we want to be able to meet so that we can continually update and maintain our structures so that they remain viable. Mr. Chairman and members, the last provision sounds quite simple on its face. And what is going on in the resort industry right now is resorters, as they have had expanded lakeshore property values, are looking at ways to try and keep their resort in business with and trying to spread that equity out through different owners. And the only thing Subdivision 5 says, Mr. Chairman, is that simply changing the ownership of your resort, so long as it operates as a resort as defined in this bill, does not change the use of your resort as it relates to zoning and density. And as resorts are looking at alternative forms of ownership, that is just an important protection that we would like to see statewide. The Congress comes to the Capitol on occasion on issues that government impacts their ability to stay in business. We're not asking you to make the sunshine, the snowfall, the fish to bite, but these are genuine problems that these small businesses have, and we would appreciate your support. There is one last thing, Mr. Chairman, in working with the local units of government that have been so helpful to us to get the bill in the shape that it's in. There's a question that in Section 2 on line 1.18 and 1.19, that the language might not be clear enough that we're only preempting local ordinances as it relates to these few provisions. We do not want to be or seek to be exempted from any other requirements that may be imposed on a resort, whether it is stormwater management or other requirements. And we may need to have language similar to 462 that makes it clear that they can impose other reasonable requirements by ordinance on the resorts as they're built. I wanted to point that out so that you know that we're not asking to be exempted from anything other than what's contained in this bill. With that, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, what lines was did you refer to?
The preemption.
1.18 and
1.8 and 1.9.
Yeah, I do, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
I do have another question. There's one sentence that it's not quite clear to me, and that's on 1.19 and 1.20. As it says on 1.15, it's that you're having for rent three or more cabins and so on,
right,
but primarily for transient use. But then this sentence says it allows no residential use of a dwelling unit or site except dwellings used as residences for the service providers or dwelling units or sites for renters. What does that mean?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson and members, what 1.19 is intended to mean and what we believe it means is that as you have that, this gets to the alternative ownership issue, and we want to make it clear that as there is alternative ownership, no one uses that as a year-round residence, so there's no residential use of the facility except for the owners of the resort. Most of the members that belong to my association live at the resort, and so we don't want to preclude them from continuing to live there. That's what that language is intended to mean, and we've vetted it several times with the DNR and others. We think we understand it. If it needs to be more clear, happy to do that, but that's what the language is supposed to say.
So, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Carlson, is the dwelling units or sites for renters actually carrying back to the other purpose? The transient?
Yes.
Okay, that's not clear. If it's for residential use other than for the service providers, this almost makes that there's something else there that you could just rent out year round.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Carlton,
and I don't think that's what you mean, but somebody could interpret it to be that way, or the sites.
Mr. Chairman and members, I don't know if you have the bill as introduced, but to address the same concern that was brought up in the House to get at residential use, we deleted, I believe, on that line for a 30-day period to make it clear that no one lived there longer than 30 days.
Mr. Chairman, you had the same exception there, too,
except
dwellings. And so you had the same exceptions there. So that really doesn't change it from the original bill. You've changed that particular wording of 30 days. But it's still that second part is not quite clear as to what sites for renters. If it's the if you wanted to say the dwelling units are site for short-term renters or or the resort, I don't know what term, but there needs to be something modifying renters there that will link it back to the main purpose of the resort rather
Carlson.
Than some other purpose.
Mr. Carlson, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, if on line 1.20 we put a period after providers, just delete the
so
balance of
that
sentence.
Hmm.
If that's, Mr. That Chairman, if that's your intent to protect that you're providing for those who are providing the service there,
right,
then I think that's all you need.
Mr. Scogin, Senator Scogin, you had a question?
No, I was going to, Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I was going to ask for some help on the wordage that she'd be comfortable with, but I think Senator
Chairman,
Olson
I think
has
Mr.
worked
Carlson
it out.
Carlson has done that. So if you want me to move it, I will move on line 1.20. After providers, insert a period and delete the rest of that sentence.
The amendment, any further discussion? Is that clear with everybody? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign, period. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson, in your testimony, you said a couple times that this is designed to help small resorts, but I don't see any definition here that limits it to small. It looks like it covers the Maddens and the Craigans as well as the Ma and Pa shops. So
Sure. What
is your intention there? And should we limit it by definition to the smaller resorts, which have a more pressing need for this help, I would think?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and members, we looked at some different definitions. Some of them are classified by property tax. Some are homestead resorts. In property tax, that's a 1C resort, and people that don't live there are called a 4C resorts. The average resort in Minnesota is 10 units or less. We have very few units in Minnesota that are the large facilities that you're referencing, whether it's Craigans or Maddens. We didn't see, in talking with others, any particular need to exclude any resorter, so that if a big facility on Gull Lake burns down, like I think the quarter deck did burn down here not too long ago, they would still have the protections of this bill, and we don't see any need to exclude them. They are still subject to all other controls that the municipality would have. This just gives them the right to rebuild, and so we didn't have a further qualifier.
Mr. Chair, before we go further with questions, maybe we could hear from Tom O'Sell from Northern Lights Resort. He's taking the time to be here today, and how this bill may be affecting him.
Thank you, Mr. O'Sell. Would you identify yourself, please?
I'm Tom O'Sell, and I own Northern Lights Resort on Lake Cabotogama. And thank you for being here. It's pretty simple. It's straightforward, and it's just something that's needed in our business. You know, for a small operator, if a cabin burns down that's too close to the lake and I can't rebuild it, it's a big deal to me. I mean, those are bottom-line dollars that I don't have anymore. Or if the health department comes in and says, you don't have a your bedroom isn't large enough, you know, you can't rent this cabin out, I got to fix it. I got to change it. If I'm too close to the water, then I've got a problem.
Senator Dittmo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I thought I heard Mr. Carlson say earlier that these provisions are already contained in state statute. So I'm wondering, I didn't quite catch what's new in this bill that's needed.
The definition.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and members, definition of a resort is new, making it clear that the two existing laws that we have right now governing nonconforming uses, Chapter 394 and 462, apply specifically to resorts in the shore impact zone, and we don't think that that is as clear as it can be in those two sections. And allowing resorts to minimally expand to meet code is a new provision that's not in existing law, and not allowing a change of ownership to constitute a change of use is new in law. So those three are new provisions.
Follow-up, sir?
Thank you. So, Ms. Carlson, why not make those changes in those sections of law rather than going to the shoreline development section? Because, you know, as we've discussed, that raises some concerns I think we'll hear about in a few minutes. And you stated in your testimony that you only want to deal with, you know, the continuance of nonconforming uses or the minimal improvement of those. But why not deal with those in those land use sections?
Mr. Carlson.
Than here.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dibble, in working with the reviser, we felt that because we wanted to deal with shoreline development, that this was more appropriately codified in this section, although there is a mix between local land use and shoreline issues. That's in working with the reviser, that's where we felt it was most appropriate.
Mr. Chair, Mr. O'Sell would like to address that question as well.
Mr. O'Sell.
Some of the things that we've seen as operators is And you guys realize that as people get their places on the lake, some of the nicer lakes, once they're there, they just soon make zoning tougher. They don't want anybody else there. They've got their place at the lake. And if they put pressure on the local boards, the local counties, to make things tougher, so that there is no more development on the lake because they've got their place at the lake, they're already there. This is what helps us. We can still run our businesses. They can't affect, or we've got all kinds of conditions to live within. And resorters are the best stewards of the water because it's what they survive on. But if on a big lake like I'm on, there's new people that get on the lake. They don't want anybody. They don't want, if a lot of wealth comes onto the lake, they don't want anybody else in the lake. So they can affect some changes with local zoning and with local commissioners. And it can be real tough. So this gives us a basis to stay alive with.
Okay. Any other questions of the two witnesses?
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering on line 1.28 if maybe the word accidental in front of the word fire should be inserted so that only structures that are accidentally burned can be replaced. Maybe being a bit paranoid here, but... It just makes it a little bit clearer.
Mr. Chairman, the local fire department needed a little practice, and that's the purpose.
Yeah.
Double purpose, then.
Mr. Carlson?
Local units of volunteer fire departments sometimes get an old structure to train on.
Mr. Carlson,
Mr. Chairman,
might be a good purpose for the resort owners.
I can tell you that... I'm unaware of any non-accidental fire that would allow a resorter to access his insurance to rebuild. So I don't think that we need to further clarify it. I do know that in my township, in Lake Eunice Township, we do have the fire department that does come and have practice fires, and whether they're at a resort or not, I don't know, but they do it. So I think it's pretty clear that the fire needs to allow the resort to continue, and if it's not accidental, they're not going to rebuild it because the money is not going to be there.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Sieben has a good point, though. I think Senator Parasol did also. I think perhaps an unintended fire would be
that's a good term.
Better than
better word.
Accidental.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I would raise the question of what about arson? That's not accidental, and it's not not caused by any negligence or bad acting on the owner, but it certainly could happen.
That's not accidental.
That's called fire.
Consider a fire.
And that's very intentional.
We're going to hear from
Senator. Would you?
So they're changing. Are they doing some amendments?
Any other comments?
What is that noise out there?
She'd throw a curve at you there.
Yeah.
yeah. That's right. Senator.
Just while people, I can see that people are trying to work on language, but I'm trying to play from the other side. You know, if it was arson or it was intentional fire, then an insurance company is going to help you rebuild it. But on the other side of that, in terms of what's trying to be accomplished here, do we really need to add the language? Because if they did burn it down on purpose, all this allows them to do is reestablish the footprint and maybe upgrade the quality of the materials that they're using and improve it. So I don't think that it really is an issue.
I don't think we're talking about too many issues here, too many times that's going to happen. So that's a good point. Any other questions or concerns?
Sure.
Any questions from the witnesses? Mr. Senator Scogan, how would you like to proceed? Do you have other witnesses?
Anybody want to speak against it, I guess?
Anybody here to speak against it?
I think I'd like to ask Mr. Osell if what he thinks about
Senator Parasol,
the fire issue that we're batting around the table here.
Mr. Osell.
Well,
as an owner, where would you?
Yes, you know, if one of my cabins burnt down and I could only rebuild the same footprint, that's fine. You know, as long as my bedrooms were of the right size, that'd be fine.
They could rebuild it.
You might if it's in that something's happened that is really damaged.
Okay, we'll proceed. Witness would like to say a few things. Just identify yourself, please.
My name is Henry Van Offlin. I'm with Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. I was on the Alternative Shoreland Standards Update process and on that committee. Back again was here in February to talk about shoreland issues, an issue near and dear to my heart. I, too, live in Otter Tail County, where Senator Scogan is from, and have also spent much time at resorts because I was not fortunate growing up to have one of those lake places. And I am here today to say that we need to strike a bit more balance with this bill, I believe. And as it stands now, this and the balance should be between the private economic interests and protecting our shoreland resources. As a member of the Shoreland Standards Update Committee, I was in full support of all the efforts that the resort representatives, the Minnesota Office of Tourism, and the DNR took to develop rules for resorts. There were many meetings outside of our committee meetings to develop the rules section specifically for resorts. Right now, one of the problems has been in Shoreland Rule, resorts are simply lumped in with planned unit developments. That's why there was no definition. The definition in your bill is virtually straight out of the Alternative Shoreland Management Standards. The resource protection requirements are an important part of the Shoreland Advisory process that we talked about back in February and were agreed to by the resort community. In front of you there are these two DNR fact sheets to give you some background. I'll pull them out too. The first one to look at is just the alternative shoreline management standard with about 9 bullets. On the back side is what those special resort standards were. This is DNR's fact sheet that we've just highlighted a bit. And you'll see there with provisions for shoreland revegetation and compliance with stormwater and wastewater treatment standards in return for the flexibility that they were given. The second worksheet or fact sheet is specifically one on Minnesota resorts. And at the bottom of that page, there is a little bit of highlighting, and then I want to point your attention mostly towards the last paragraph that's highlighted. In return, resorts must also restore and maintain a certain portion of the shore impact zone to its natural state. Larger resorts must develop erosion control, etc. So this was dealt with at length in the advisory committee. And they worked hard to work with the resort community to develop some standards where there was give and take. Now this bill, as it stands, really is just cherry-picking the voluntary standards for the benefit of one interest group, and it does not bring into effect any of the resource protection components mentioned in those fact sheets. And I think there's also some other policy implications of this bill. First, this is likely to open the door for additional selective legislation as other interest groups come before you to take their favorite pieces of those voluntary standards and put them into law. DNR has been very clear that they want local governments in voluntary control of these voluntary standards. The bill, is really a switch from that approach of voluntary. This year already we had a lake association that wanted to take the controlled access portion, that funneling of non-riparian owners, people that buy 40 acres, develop it, and then funnel everybody through a lot. That's one of the provisions in the voluntary standards. We did have a lake association that wanted to come before you, wanted to go and cherry-pick that piece out of the alt standards and bring it into law. We did not support that when they were interested in doing that. The shoreline buffer section, the plan unit development standards, all could be pulled out and be in front of you after this, if this bill is approved. Another policy implication for you to consider is that this bill undermines the voluntary standards process. As I understood the bill, at least before there was some clarification by Mr. Carlson, I was under the impression if a county had adopted the voluntary standards for resorts, the comprehensive standards, that this bill would essentially preempt, as the first line says, their ability to put in stormwater, erosion control, or vegetation standards. So that's a second concern. And then finally, I think there is a third policy implication for you to consider, is that this bill could possibly increase the conversion of resorts to high-density developments. That is a big concern. It's in Mr. Carlson's memorandum. As far as I can tell, this bill does not prevent someone to, in the next year or two or three, upgrade all their cabins using the provisions in this bill and then convert their resort to a different ownership or a PUD. So they'd be allowed to do some things which they are not allowed to do now. There is no disincentive for that. And in the voluntary standards, there is a built-in disincentive for resort conversions. That was something the resort folks, and there were five of them on that committee, wanted, is disincentives for going from a resort to a planned unit development. This does not do that. If you wanted to do that, you would have to pull about 20 pages out of those voluntary standards in order to provide disincentives for resorts not to be converted. So that is in rules. And that sort of gets back to the tool in the toolbox that I think is even on that one fact sheet at the top, voluntary tools. A lot of the tools in that toolbox, I think, are somewhat magnetic. They stick together. You pull one out, and you need to pull out others. I could really see, there's no disincentives here for keeping resorts. There's incentives to give them the flexibility. I totally agree with the flexibility, but we do need some provisions in return to ensure resource protection. as I understood it, before the clarification, perhaps this does preempt local government control, and we need to make sure that there is some control by local governments to put provisions to do things like shoreline buffers, stormwater management. So, with that, thank you for your time,
Senator Dibble.
Well, thanks. Well, I'd like to offer the A3 amendment that was developed to kind of respond to some of these concerns for the committee's consideration.
Okay.
While it's being passed out, the first part of the amendment deals with the issue that Mr. Carlson raised in his testimony, in which he said that it was the goal of this legislation not to preempt other kinds of local ordinances, but to preempt the local ordinances that deal with non-conforming uses. I think that's appropriate. That's a good goal. I support the continuation of particularly the mom-and-pop resorts. I had the pleasure of going up to these little tiny mom-and-pop resorts when I was a kid with my family up in the Alexandria area. And it was really fun, and I think we should do what we can to make sure that they continue. So the first part of this amendment tries to accomplish that. Now, I think Senator Stump has a different view of how that language reads, so we can talk about that a little bit. He thinks it has the opposite effect, or has the effect of maybe harming the ability of the mom and pops to continue. So I'd like to hear more about what Senator Stump has to say about that. And then the second part just has to do with these modest cabin improvements to bring folks up to code. In those instances, then it would trigger some of those shoreland buffer, some of those environmental concerns that you find in the alternative minimum standards for shoreland protection to protect the water resource on the lakes. As I understand that these were developed through the deliberative process, they're fairly modest in their reach and their scope. So that's my amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Offern wants to provide more information.
Mr. Van Offlin, did you want to comment on the amendment?
Oh, sorry. I would support the amendment. It gives some clarification to the preemption concerns that we have, and it also makes this bill minimally more consistent with the voluntary standards. The voluntary standards for resorts is five full pages. There was a lot of work that went into that. This does give a little bit more balance to the bill. And so I think the amendment certainly helps this.
Whoever can answer, is this new subdivision 6 part of the alternative shoreline standards developed by the DNR? Mr. Van Offlin?
Yes. Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, it is not exactly, the definition that is in the bill in front of you is almost pulled directly out of the alternatives or the voluntary standards. This shoreline buffer erosion control and stormwater management is not exactly being pulled out. It couldn't be done that way because the other subdivisions here are not exactly the same. So this is consistent with them. It's not identical to them, I would say.
Senator Olson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, not having as a child or an adult been experienced some of these small resorts, how many resorts would have cabins that might currently be closer than 35 feet from a shoreline?
I was looking at that section.
Was that to Mr.
Standing
Carlson?
From the shoreline land, 35 feet.
Mr. Carlson?
Are there any?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, I'm certain that there are. How many, I can't tell you, but I'm certain that there are. I'd like to remind the committee that if I have a cabin that is within 35 feet of the lakeshore and the local jurisdiction has requirements for rebuilding that structure, whether it's a surface water runoff plan or septic requirements, I still have to comply with all of those. This bill only gives me the right to keep my business operating if it's lost to a disaster. That's all that it does. If they have other controls that are required, I still have to comply with those. And in working with local units of government, this is exactly the kind of prescriptive requirements that they have kind of argued against. That's why you're seeing the bill the way it is. They want to develop locally what works for them as it relates to buffer, revegetation, and we're happy to comply with them if they're adopted and they apply to us. What they have not wanted, local governments and the DNR have not wanted to take the alternative standards and force them into a statewide law. And that is why the bill that is before you is written the way it is, because it gives us the ability, the right, to stay in business, but it allows local governments to control that development. This, all the bill does is give us the right. Whatever those local zoning controls are, we have to comply with. And, you know, even on the handouts, which I've used myself at other hearings, you know, if a county chooses to adopt all or parts of the alternative standards, it has to conduct a public hearing. But even the DNR recognizes that the tools in the toolbox were for the counties to use as they saw fit. If you liked parts of it, adopt it. If you don't like parts of it, you don't have to adopt it. And it was done in a voluntary basis that that we freely participated in. But it wasn't a mandatory rulemaking process, which the MCAA would like the DNR to do. They want us to help sue the DNR to make them do it. And we said, no, we think we can get more done in this fashion. And so we have opposition to the amendment. And even though the clarifying language on the amendment on 1.3 does address the concern, we think there is better language available, and we'd like the ability to work with local units of government to address that. The language in 462 talks about reasonable requirements imposed by ordinance by a local unit of government, and it talks about health, safety, and environment, and to the extent we need to do that to satisfy local units of government, we'd like to do that. This is the first I've seen this after this is my fourth hearing on this bill, so I'm a little bit hesitant to accept it because I don't know exactly all what it entails. But if local governments need more protection to make sure they can have adequate controls, we're happy to work with them to do that.
Mr. Chair.
Regardless, with respects, Mr. Carlson, your bill is the one that is prescriptive to local governments. It preempts local ordinances that are inconsistent with its terms. So, if you want the goose, don't you have to take the gander?
Mr. Chairman and members, if you look at what the current law is relative to nonconforming uses, they're already goosed. We already have that. And to the extent the ownership issue and minimally expanding to meet code is a new issue, we think that keeping resorts viable is an important statewide policy that warrants the bill in front of you. And so as it relates to the maintenance, rebuilding, those issues are already there. And this just makes it clear that it applies to resorts. But that is existing law. So it's only those two other areas that we're really picking up on.
Yeah. I don't think it doesn't look like the amendment changes what you desire. Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman, let me see if I understand this correctly. You were just saying that the you or the resorts do not want to preempt the local law. Is that correct?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and members, to the extent their ordinances preclude rebuilding a resort after a fire, we think that current law preempts a local ordinance in that regard, and this just additionally makes it clear as it relates to the shore impact zone.
So, Mr. Chairman, on the first part of the amendment, that 1.3 and 1.4, it sounds as if your information is that the resorts could work with that?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Stump, we may word it a little more artfully based on current law, but that concept is something that we do not oppose.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to divide the amendment, divide out 1.3 and 1.4, and then the rest of the amendment.
Does he mean 1.4 and 1.5?
Yeah. No, he means 1.3 and 1.4.
No, divide it between.
But between those. He wants to take that as a side.
Okay, so but you're moving to divide the A3 amendment between lines 1.4 and 1.5.
Mr. Chairman, correct.
All right. The amendment is divisible. So we'll move on to debate on first of the two, Senator Dibble, I believe it's your choice, which we discuss first.
Mr. Chair, I think that makes sense. Why don't we just go ahead and vote on the first part?
Okay.
And then I have a question about the second part.
Mr. Chair, we do not oppose that point 3 and point 4 amendment.
Okay. I have a request from Mr. Johnson. On the first part, go ahead. Come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Craig Johnson. I'm representing the League of Minnesota Cities. And to the first part of the amendment, the language that was added here is something we discussed earlier in the day. This is not exactly what we discussed. We're struggling to make sure we understand exactly what this does to local ordinances. When you broadly say does not preempt local ordinances that provide additional protection of shoreland, an ordinance can contain many provisions that may go further than we want it to go. Mr. Carlson referred to earlier is actually something I think local governments are far more used to dealing with and would avoid litigation is closer to the language that's in Chapter 462 that refers to conditions related to public health, safety, welfare, and in this case we could add or shoreland protection, environmental protection, something along those lines. If the language is added in this form, I would hope we could work to correct that to be closer to existing local regulations on nonconforming uses before the local government committee hearing. So one way or the other, I would hope we could get that addressed because we would not want to open up a situation where our communities are not entirely clear how they can enact shoreland protections. Most of them want to have those, and it varies greatly how they want to enact them, which ones they think will be most useful in their communities. But we don't want them to doubt whether they can have them or whether they have to isolate them in some way to make them exempt from other portions of this law.
So, Mr. Chair, I think that was just a long-winded way of saying we were not very artful, but I think it would still be important to include this if it's consistent with the intent of the author and the proponents as it goes forward to local government committee.
Okay.
We can be more artful.
Mr. Chairman and
Mr. O'Sell.
And committee, when there's talk about shoreline management, the resorts that exist today, before they can sell, they have to have a certificate of compliance on their sewer systems. They're inspected every year on their water systems. They're already inspected a lot. The resorts, they'll have five, 10 cabins all going into one sewer system and pumping away from the lake. You know, the biggest issue about shoreline management in today's world is sewer getting into the lakes. And the resorts are the operations that are in compliance. It's the private cabin owners that don't have the regulations. They don't sometimes have enough land. They have a sewer system for every cabin. We're collectively, you know, at my resort, I pre-treat all my sewer. My sewer is pumped anywhere from 700 to 1,300 feet back from the lake, and it's pre-treated. And so I kind of bristle when I hear about shoreline management because I know the resorters are the best at it.
Mr. Russell, what about stormwater runoff? Is that part of shoreline practices? And
yeah, I think it is because from a practical matter, it's erosion. It damages your property, and it's erosion. And every operator deals with that. So, I mean, I just don't. And I've been around a lot of resorts over a lot of years, and I don't see there's a lot of cabins that there probably are cabins that are 35 feet from the water, but there's not a lot.
I don't understand that. You've got a boat ramp that is basically a direct channel constructed for stormwater to run off into the lake. I would venture to say every resort has one of those.
A lot of resorts,
at the very least,
a lot of resorts don't have their own boat ramps.
What? Pardon?
A lot of resorts don't have their own boat ramps. It's not shoreline is so valuable nowadays. It's a lot cheaper to use the one down the road than you put one in on your own property. It's not practical, and it all depends on and some of the ramps that are of the cement slabs and the gravel, cement slabs and gravel, you know, that doesn't have runoff, you know.
Now, what about erosion from the lake itself? How do we address those issues? Hmm? That's not a septic issue, but how do we address that in the rules?
Can't stop the waves, Mr. Chairman.
I mean, I don't know how you can have laws or rules to deal with that. I mean, that's Mother Nature. It's wind, it's wave, or it's the height of the lake, all of those issues. I've had issues at my resort where I have to riprap it and put in rocks, cloth and rocks, to deal with that issue. Mm-hmm. But it's just everybody just deals with it, you know.
Well, the part of the alternative shoreline standards is to get everyone to deal with it. And that's what part of what the amendment is saying. It's not just septic is what you're saying. It deals with stormwater practices. It deals with erosion.
Not in the first.
And
line.
So I think that's what the amendment is saying. It's more than just septic. Let's see here. I think Mr. Van Offlin wanted to testify. We're still on part one, by the way.
I forgot.
Yep. Okay.
Well, let me just thank you, Mr. Chair. Add one comment. We did not put any of the sanitary provisions in here. It's stormwater erosion control. Those are the simpler pieces to pull out. So this affects those issues from when I called.
All right. So the part one of the amendment that we're voting on is lines 1.3 and 1.4. Does everybody understand that? Senator Scogin, did you have anything else?
No.
Okay. So all those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Now to the second part of the A3 amendment. Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I guess I never heard an answer to one of the issues that was raised, and that is conversion of these units from cabins and resorts to homes or condos or whatever it may be. How do we prevent that from happening once they're all rebuilt and take advantage of this exemption and then decide they want to sell out?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, there are, I think, several protections in the language right in front of you that address that. First of all, the definition of a resort requires that the units be available for rental to the public. That's number one. You can't have individual owners using the unit the whole time. It does. If you do that and sell them off individually, you are moving over to a conversion and a planned unit development, and you no longer get the protections of this.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Carlson, that's not what
Senator
I'm.
Anderson.
That's not what I'm not asking about. The use of the law if we pass it. Obviously, that's limited to something that's a current resort. But I think what Mr. Van Offelen was suggesting is that a resort, while operating as a resort, could make use of this, and then they could sell, and be in effect. An owner who intended to sell could do something that they wouldn't be able to do after they sold it and put it under a different form of ownership. And so how do you prevent that from happening?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, I think he's misreading what the bill says and does. That is not what it allows. If you look on 2.4 and 2.5, the property has to continue to operate as a resort, be available for use to the public. If they sell it off and make deeded real estate of individual units, this does not apply, and whatever requirements the county has relative to conversion of that property would control.
But Mr. Chair, they would have already made the improvements. So you could have someone who owns a resort, is planning to sell off their resort. You know, they're ready to retire or whatever. They make it take advantage of this law, fix up all the units, have them, you know, and then sell it and to a different use, which they took advantage of their status as a resort to make the improvements. Because if they sold it first, they wouldn't be able to make those improvements, correct?
I can answer that.
Mr. O'Sell.
In my county, if in St. Louis County, if you have a resort and you want to subdivide it into private homes and you don't have it in the rental pool, they only allow a certain amount of density.
It's a resort.
So they're going to add up your – they're going to measure out your shoreline. They're going to take off for wetlands. They're going to take off everything, and they're going to give you calculations, and they'll only allow so many – units on that amount of space. If you have 10 and they only allow 4, you've got to get rid of 6. If you keep your resort operating as a resort, even if it was is with private ownership of the cabins, as long as those cabins stay in a rental pool, then you are allowed probably the density you already have, so you could function as a resort.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd like Mr. Van Offelen to clarify those comments, because I'm not clear on what he meant, given the response I'm getting.
Mr. Van Offelen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson. I think I was reading the bill correctly, and I, you know, one of the things this does allow, as you said, upgrades, which is fine. I think we all want resorts to stay in business. Mr. Carlson's memorandum on the second paragraph, you know, there's pressures on small resorts to sell. I don't see where this bill helps that whatsoever, because those pressures are still going to be there. Now, we talked about those pressures at length on that committee, and that's where we had automatic and strict disincentives for flipping resorts into other uses to protect small resorts. That's not what is in here, from my perspective.
Mr. Chairman,
can I just
follow up
to that? So, can you just give me an idea of what those disincentives would look like? Because I'm not.
Mr. Van Offelen.
Mr. Chair,
I don't know what they are.
Members, yes, there was. There's two references in the resort standards which would, they would need to have the zoning provisions, which is all your lot sizes, et cetera. They would have to meet those. They would have to meet, and then they would also have to meet the planned unit development standards. And if the densities of your existing buildings were greater than what the planned unit development standards are, you would have to make some changes to that. If your impervious surface was over, I can't recall off the top of my head, 15 or 20%, you would have to mitigate your stormwater if you wanted to maintain your higher densities. That's how those work. Does that help? I mean, the disincentive was if you converted it, you'd have to meet stricter standards than most counties have today.
Senator Barrasso.
Mr. Chairman, in sub 2, resort defined, the entire paragraph, which is quite long, defines everything that Senator Anderson was asking about. First, it tells you how a resort is determined, and then it says these establishments must be primarily service-oriented for transient, and they'll allow no residential use of dwelling units except for the people who are service providers. And then lastly, that qualifying as a resort means you must be fully licensed and permitted under state and local regs.
Mr. Chair,
think that kind of answers most of your concerns.
Senator Pearson,
because if they're going to be in condos or individual residential, they're not going to be a resort anymore.
I know, that's kind of my point. They wouldn't be a resort
well,
anymore.
Well, the fact is,
I don't think we're disagreeing about what the
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair.
Point.
All right, Senator Olson. Mr. Chair, maybe I can preempt this. And, hey, that's our word for the night, preempt. I think I'd like to withdraw the second part of the amendment. Maybe we can dispense with this, because I think I hear that when the resort is sold and converted to a condo, then a lot of these provisions may be triggered, you know, depending, of course, on what the local unit adopts, because, of course, these standards are voluntary at this point. So I think I'm hearing agreement here, but people aren't quite hearing each other, so I'll just withdraw the second part of the amendment.
Senator Olson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think the change of ownership, to me, this issue protects the ability of an owner that wants to continue in the resort business to be able to do so, even if there are things, if they need to make some improvements, to be able to make it a viable business, to be able to do that and not feel that they have to sell, that that's their only option. And secondly, that they can, in fact, sell it or change ownership, whether it's to a family, other family member that would like to continue that tradition. It doesn't say anything about the sale for somebody who might want to use it differently. But once that happens, I don't know why anybody would want to invest in improving something that the local unit of government is likely to change. And I'm not sure what if the I guess maybe the league would have to address is if they are desirous of trying to push resorts into big condo units on these lakes. Is that what the local units really want? Is that what you're saying? Is that what you're afraid of?
Is that
well, whoever?
Mr. Van Offlin.
Well, I think we've mentioned that resorts have gone from 3,000 to I think 900 or so. Was that the statistic? There's many conversions of resorts going on.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think it's pretty clear the pressures that are on resorts because of increased valuation along these lakeshore properties. It's, you know, they're so. The land is so valuable that I think it's very difficult, and I understand why that's why they want this bill. I get that, because they're under so much pressure to make a living when they could make a lot more money perhaps selling this off and developing it in a different way. And so I just want to make sure that carving out an exception for them does not have the unintended consequence of allowing, you know, someone to sort of use this and then flip it. But that's what I'm trying to understand is if there's going to be other requirements that are so onerous that it won't work that way, that's not a barrier. I'm trying to understand that.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator
are resorts protected from the business proper or statewide business property tax, or do they pay that?
Mr. Chairman and members, it depends on what kind of resort you are. If you are a homestead resort, you are not in the statewide business assessment. If you are a non-homestead Class 4C resort, you are in the statewide. So it depends on what kind of resort you are.
So that doesn't help resorts either.
Senator Sharon?
I need to vote on this.
Just to, tonight. This is withdrawn, but just to get back to Senator Anderson's question, maybe if I ask the question this way. Once a property converts from one use to another use, so now it is a residential property, at that point, the municipal government or the government in authority can require them to meet zoning requirements under that law, including setback requirements, yes, including side yard requirements, everything, including water drainage requirements. So if that happens, if the resort owner builds something and sells it as an individual unit, once it converts from one zone to another zone, then the unit of government has the authority to say you have to go back 100 feet. They're not grandfathered in other words. Right. Is that correct?
Right. That's absolutely right. And I got to tell you, before you can transfer deed to that property when you subdivide it, somebody's going to want to know what their rights are. And you are not going to be able to subdivide that property without going through a plat approval and zoning approvals, all of which, if you're not going to operate it as a resort anymore, all of the world changes for you. And the controls are already there, and this doesn't exempt any resort from those requirements.
Mr. Van Offlin, then I want to talk to the DNR.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have seen resorts go from 3,000 to 900 with these provisions already in place regarding zoning and flipping. They are still flipping into other uses, and the zoning rules, which we want to defer to at this point, have all been in place and have not stopped resort conversions. So just wanted to bring that up, that I think it is a... it is a concern, you know, and my concerns mainly in this committee are environmental concerns, not these. And I, you know, it's we're allowing local governments to control provisions for shorelands, but they aren't, you know, they're not allowed to do the to have any control over preempt. You know, they're being preempted in these other issues. So,
Mr. Lacismo. Here's the problem I have. Next session, there will be at least one bill. My guess is several, if not more, dealing with other parts of the alternative shoreline standards. Something that one special interest liked about the alternative shoreline standards. And now they want that to be law. That appears to be what's going on with this bill. Not that it's not a worthy bill, but I thought that Minnesota's shoreland regulations were in rule, not statute. Is that true?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Kent Lacismo, Division of Waters for DNR. Yes, that's true. The standards for shoreland development are in rule.
When were the last set of rules adopted?
1989.
Okay. Why do we have alternative shoreline standards now?
Mr. Chairman.
If we already have rules in place.
Mr. Chairman, we went through a process through the, it's actually part of the Governor's Clean Water Initiative to look at some alternatives. We selected the North Central, five counties in North Central Minnesota as the, you know, it's kind of the lake counties, to look at what would alternative standards be? What improvements could we make to the existing shoreland rules? We had a 34-member work group that discussed these alternative standards and discussed the issues that were most important to those members, and came up with a set of voluntary alternative standards, and those are being used in some counties have adopted parts of those. They're used outside of the five county pilot area, and counties are
are being encouraged, I think, by AMC and by others to adopt the portions that make sense for them. So counties are adopting pieces of them. Nobody's adopting the entire set. We're in the process of having discussions internally and within DNR on how we should approach new rules for shoreline management, but it would be done on the front end with everybody understanding we're looking at mandatory statewide rules. So we're having those discussions on how we would approach a new rulemaking process. The alternative standards, will we see proposals from other entities to pick up pieces of this next session? That's quite possible. We certainly have supported the idea of doing something so we can keep resorts. I mean, that was very clear in the years leading up to the alternative shoreland standard development, and that there were issues for small resorts and how we kept those resorts functioning. So the we certainly think that there's some benefit in dealing with keeping resorts. The last discussion that Senator Anderson had raised, I think, you know, we could add some language into subdivision 5 on the, you know, after 2.5 that clarifies what would happen if there is a conversion. I think that might help.
Okay. So is it the policy of the DNR now that we need to update shoreline standards?
Mr. Chairman, we're having discussions internally. We're meeting with the commissioner later this month to discuss the routes that we could follow to get to that point. Undertaking a rule process like the shoreland rules is a could be a lengthy and expensive process, so we need to look at the options available to us to get there.
Does the DNR feel that we need new shoreline standards? Do we need to update the shoreline standards that were last updated in 1989?
Mr. Chairman, they're 18 years old, and I think through the alternative shoreline process, we developed some areas there that clearly, and there was good science that went into the development of these, that there are areas that can be improved. We did reach consensus in the alternative shoreline standards process because early on in that process, they were designed to be a voluntary set of standards. When we start out with a new rule process to do a mandatory statewide set of standards, we may not be able to get as far as we did on some of those areas, but they are, like you say, 18 years old. It is time to take a serious look at updating those existing standards.
When were the alternative shoreline standards released?
Mr. Chairman, December of 2005.
Okay. Isn't that kind of a long time between then and now, where you're considering implementing new rules?
Mr. Chairman, what we've been doing in the interim and phase three of that process was to market those voluntary standards to the counties, and we've just completed four training sessions with local governments that had pretty good attendance. There were 150 attendees to those. I'm not sure how many local governments that involved to learn more about those and be exposed to them. We are going out and talking with county boards. We're encouraging that. I understand the Association of Minnesota Counties is going to encourage members to take a serious look at adopting the appropriate standards. So we are marketing. The voluntary approach to enhance these standards is sometimes more beneficial than the heavy-handed approach. And quite frankly, that's what happened in 1989. We started out with a rule that met with significant opposition. We backtracked, developed a 20-some member work group that developed a standard that we ultimately took to rule. So rulemaking works better if you start from the ground with a wide assortment of interested parties and develop consensus and take that to rulemaking.
And when will that
rulemaking begin?
Mr. Chairman, that has not been decided yet. We're looking at the options and whether or not there's the financial capabilities within the department to be able to do that. Certainly within it's three or four staff people over a number of years to accomplish that, and then it's the adoption process that follows the actual rule process.
How long did the 1989 rules take to implement or to create?
Mr. Chairman, to create it probably about 4 years, because there was a study in the mid-1980s, and then that evolved into the formal rulemaking process. And then following the 1989 adoption, having each of the local governments adopt probably took another 4 years. And at that time, there was $1 million appropriated a year from the state to encourage and assist in the adoption. That money were grants to local governments. Okay.
So it takes a long time.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
So if we want to get some new shoreline standards, we better get going.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and we are moving.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman?
That, to me, is the problem. Senator Fredrickson.
I thought you were through this.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment I'd like to make on you.
Okay. Senator Scogin, did you have a response? Okay, Senator Fredrickson.
I was going to move the bill, Mr. Chair, so.
I think we got an amendment.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman and members, I have three or four places where I'd like to make some phrasing changes in the bill. And page 1, line 15, delete those, insert persons.
Could you repeat that, Senator?
Mr. Chairman, members, page 1, line 15, delete those, insert persons. On line 16, delete these establishments and insert a shoreland commercial establishment.
A shoreland commercial establishment.
Shoreline. On line 19, after resorts, insert must not and delete no. On line 26, delete which includes replacing and insert including the replacement of. On line 27, after structure, add a comma, delete that do and insert while, and then delete increase the structure and insert increasing the structures. And after footprint, insert on the land. On line 33, delete such, insert the word the.
How did we know that such would come out?
Just that.
On line 34, after that, insert did not exist in. And then on line 34 and 35, delete did not have.
Senator Fredrickson, can you repeat that?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Knopf and I were talking about these changes, and I think he has all of these, and I don't think there's any substantive change to the bill. It's just
grammatical amendment by Senator Fredrickson. Does everyone understand it? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted.
Can I move the bill, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead. Before we do that, we're not going to go through this every session. We're not going to create shoreline standards for one group. Because they're better organized, or they have the better lobbyist, or anything like that. These are based upon standards that are meant for our environment and our lakeshore. This was an important provision that was discussed as part of a comprehensive package of alternative shoreline standards.
I'm very sympathetic to Senator Scogin's bill because when I was up at the cabin this past break, I was at the High Banks Resort, which is just down the road, and the guy was, the owner of the resort was just about ready to sell because he needed to repair his shed. His shed that was falling down, the original shed, and the township wasn't going to let him repair that shed. And that's where he stores his boat accessories. So you got to have that there. So I am very sympathetic to what the resorts are experiencing, particularly the small ones. But at the same time, the township required him to do some things along a shoreline, which he grumbled about, but I think we're positive. So we have such a great tradition in this state of small resorts and how they contribute to our outdoor recreation. And I think that's why I support this bill. But we're not going to have a whole series of bills next session dealing with one piece of alternative shoreline standards, because that benefits this business or that benefits that particular type of shoreline or wetland. The Minnesota shoreline regulations are in rule. And if we want to go through and have a bill this thick that adopts the alternative shoreline standards into statute, we can do that. We can do that. We can sit here for days taking testimony on those standards. Or the DNR, which it says, which it admits, the shoreline regulations need updating, can get on it, because it's going to take a while. And so we need to be implementing those. Whatever rules they implement, they need to be doing them. They need to be doing them. I appreciate the department's comments, but I also am a bit concerned that we're not progressing the way we should. So sorry about that venting. But if these rules were moving along, we wouldn't have to be here late at night. Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a slightly different perspective. We all got this alternative standard management sheet of paper here, and you see the five counties that are outlined with the alternative shoreline management standards. And we worked into that. As I look at those five counties, one thing that I do see in common, because I've been in most of these counties, are the regulations for resorts. And, I sympathize with what's happened here and why it makes sense to do the resorts. But when I look at Itasca County and Rowing County, and we talk about the fact that we're going to we can come together and all of a sudden get a set of circumstances or shoreline standards that's going to satisfy those two counties, which are really different in density and public lands and all the same things we fight over some other issues, say ATVs about. It's just not a cookie-cutter approach. It's like making law. What the DNR has to do is it's like sausage. They have to take each county at a time and do a lot of thinking. So I think it is going to be a slow go. It's not a bad thing to encourage them with words, and I don't disagree with what you said, but I think we've got to make sure that we understand that these, even in this group of related five counties, that there was many differences. One of them, which I don't think was the resorts, which I think we've taken care of this evening, or will.
And that's what the rulemaking process is for, not late night committee hearings. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will admit that I'm significantly soothed by the discussion and the debate, and my hackles aren't quite as far up. I think we saw this bill come in, and it looked like, on its face, because it's written to this section of statute and with some of the phrasing in it, it looked like small resorts were presenting one argument, but really trying to deal with another issue, and that was, they're presenting the argument that they wanted to be able to perpetuate themselves, which is a laudable goal, and I support that, but we're trying to duck kind of their environmental, obligations. I think we've received some assurance that is not the case, and so we got some language, as inartful as it is, included, that'll allow us to deal with those issues going forward, at least at the local level. And I understand that currently the alternative shoreline standards are voluntary, and that's part of why I withdrew this language in the second part of the amendment, because, like you said, we don't want to be placing all of the provisions in statute if they're more a function of rules and going through the rule process. But I would continue to urge the small resorts to be sensitive to the concerns that were articulated in this debate, because I don't think this issue is going away, and we're going to have to confront it and deal with it. If not in the rules process, we're certainly going to see it land in our lap over at the legislature, which is probably less desirable for everyone involved.
Okay, Senator Scogin.
Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate File 961 as amended to be recommended to pass and be referred to the local government.
Further discussion?
Local government.
Members, we're meeting at 12:30 tomorrow. A lot of bills. No less controversy. So appreciate everyone's hard work. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Meeting's adjourned.